Committee on Ways and Means, Public Safety Subcommittee for Wednesday, March 9th, 2005. We are also opening a public hearing on House Bill 5057, the Oregon Department of State Police. Before we get into hearing testimony from the department, just want to let members know and folks in our audience who are following the progress of Senator Winters. As far as we know, she's still in surgery, which began at 11. And so we're all holding her in prayer, and we know that there will be a good outcome. I wanted to share that with you. Expect that Senator Devlin will be joining us shortly. It is our intent to finish up with the Oregon Department of State Police this afternoon. And we will see. Mr. Wilson, do you have any comments to help frame the discussion?
Not necessarily to frame the discussion, but to make sure I don't forget, Sheila just handed me a note about tomorrow. The plan is to meet in this room at 1 o'clock and then divide up on who's going where. Transportation will be provided. I think some are going to Hillcrest, some are going to McLaren. So meet it here right at 1 o'clock, and they'll take it from there, I guess.
Very good. Thank you very much for helping us with those arrangements.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know the return time, or do you have a close estimate on that?
I'll check with Sheila after the meeting gets started, and we can close on that.
The only reason, Madam Chair, is I have a Senate hearing in Cottage Grove, because it was going to take an hour and 35 minutes.
That's six.
Okay.
Does he get special consideration if he's not the speaker?
Would you leave me alone if I have to hurry? Take it back.
Also, just another, for the good of the order, I will need to step out around 10 minutes to 3 in order to testify on Senate Bill 1, which is mental health parity. And I may need to pass the gavel to Representative Hansen, if you would be present and willing to do that, if Senator Devlin is not available. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Please go forward. Tell us where you, what page you're on and where you'd like to start.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yesterday I was about halfway through our overview of Information Management Division, which begins on page 32. And if you recall, we had briefly discussed Enterprise Services section, which is our computer folks, the Wireless Communications section, and we'll start today on page 33 with Criminal Justice Information Services section.
And you will please identify yourself for the record?
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Major Peter Spiro.
Thank you.
I have here at the table with me, too, also for the record, Mr. Terry O'Connell, who is the in charge of the Criminal Justice Information Services section. This program, probably more readily recognizable as LEDS, the Law Enforcement Data Systems, but it has other programs besides just that message switch. But they provide a broad range of public safety services to both state and local government. And they do maintain the statewide criminal justice telecommunication network, the LEDS message switch, which is, since I'm not a technical person, it's the conduit for agencies to communicate criminal justice information both across the state of Oregon and across the country among other states and with the federal government. This is the system that, for example, a police officer would query to check whether someone was wanted, or whether a car was stolen, whether a piece of equipment or property was stolen. It's the process we use to check driving records. It's that particular computer system. Therefore, our customers are pretty broad-based for this section. They're all state, local law enforcement, all federal law enforcement, We have close working relationship with the FBI with this section. In fact, the division director, Mr. Yandell, is at an FBI working group conference today dealing with issues related to this particular section. Some of the services of this section include, as I mentioned, the LEDS message switch, which is a computerized program that allows us to communicate both in-state and out-of-state, the LEDS computer files, which are used by law enforcement and criminal justice agencies across the country. We have our LEDS, our Law Enforcement Data Systems Center, which is staffed by 24/7 employees that are experts in law enforcement information systems and are able to assist other agencies, other law enforcement agencies, with investigative techniques by using these different systems. We also have, as part of this section, the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting Unit, which is charged with compiling the crime stats, for lack of a better term, for the state of Oregon. There was some discussion yesterday at the conclusion of Operations Services Bureau about the OUCR program and the impact that that program has on the state. Essentially, at this time, that program is being operated at a scaled-back level, funded with some grant funds. That unit was eliminated through some of the budget reduction processes. It has been restored in the upcoming biennium. However, it is funded out of Division S&S, which is going to cause us to have a shortfall in that particular area. This program is essential to the state for a lot of reasons. Statistics are used at policy levels by institutions such as the legislature, but they're also used to support millions of dollars of grant fund applications. The information, it's a critical program, and we found out as soon as the program was eliminated, the needs popped up routinely for that information. We continue to have requests for it. As mentioned yesterday, and I'll let Mr. O'Connell speak to this, we are currently having a backlog in that unit because of the elimination of the program. We haven't caught back up yet. So I'd ask Mr. O'Connell just to kind of give us an update on the UCR program.
Madam Chair, the program is functioning with three personnel.
Mr. O'Connell, excuse me, if you would identify yourself for the record and let the record also show that we have a quorum.
Madam Chair, my name is Terry O'Connell. I'm Director of the Oregon State Police Criminal Justice Information Services Section, of which the OCUR program is part of that. The OUCR program is Oregon Crime Reporting Unit, and they gather statistics from all agencies, about 275 agencies from around the state, and report those statistics like the major identified. There's three personnel in that section. The fact that they were closed for almost a year has resulted in a backlog in them reporting that information. I am happy to say, though, that they're making great strides in that, and we're just completing our 2004 information reporting to the FBI, allowing lots of agencies to now qualify for grant funding through 2005-2004.
The next section that I want to talk about as far as just the initial overview is the Identification Services section. I have here in the audience with me Tricia Whitfield, who's the director of that section, but as I give you an overview, if we have questions, she'll be available to answer them. The Identification Services section is the state's central repository for criminal or computerized criminal history records. It's also the place where our fingerprint files are located, and we have a system that includes a little over a million, about 1.1 million criminal history records and fingerprint files, and those this section is charged with maintenance and upkeep of those records, which is a huge process. It involves a lot of interaction with the courts and our partners, such as sheriff's departments, to keep the records accurate and to keep them updated. The section also has interaction with the FBI, as they have a similar unit, much larger unit, of course, but the FBI Identification Division interacts with the identification section on a regular basis. The goal, of course, of this section is to maintain accurate computerized criminal history files that can be used by the criminal justice system. They're also charged with expunging records that have been ordered to be expunged. They provide a broad spectrum of services, such as personal fingerprint, personal fingerprinting. Various people have needs for that. They run programs that allow churches and other organizations to check the criminal history of employees, and the broad-based responsibility. They have about 73 FTEs at the Identification Services section. Seven of those are managers. They're responsible for let me put it this way. They have some significant sections, such as handgun insta-check. They are responsible for interacting with the handgun and firearms dealers and confirming whether or not someone should be allowed to buy a firearm. They are the folks that provide the information that is run through Mr. O'Connell's shop in the lead section. They keep the data current that is accessed by the criminal justice system through the law enforcement data system. They keep that information current so that the system as a whole operates with timely and current information. Their customers include all the police departments in the state, and that includes federal the federal government. They also deal with over 300 courts. They do pre-employment background checks for schools. They are responsible for background checks and licensing and regulatory boards such as nursing, realtors, private security, lottery, massage therapists, healthcare workers, just to name a few. I've already mentioned the firearms insta-check folks. They deal with not only just organizations such as BuyMart that sell firearms, but they deal with handgun dealers at gun shows and those kinds of things that are required to check before they sell their firearms.
Major, you mentioned the expungement of certain records. Could you say more about that process? How does that work? What records get expunged? What happens to those records?
Patricia, come forward. Madam Chair, essentially expungements work. A judge, court, issues an expungement order. I'm not exactly sure what all the criteria are, but once that expungement order is issued, the agencies that have those records are required to remove them and have them destroyed. And one of those agencies, since they're the central repository for the criminal history records, we get those expungement orders, and we have to purge our files of those. In addition, our criminal division would have to, for example, purge crime reports related to the same incident. So it's not just this section, but it's one of their. They have a section that primarily deals with that because they have so many criminal history records.
Essentially, you have answered the question. The records are then actually destroyed.
Yes, ma'am.
And destroyed in what manner?
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Patricia Whitfield, Section Director of Identification Services Section. And our section is tasked with processing those expungements. There is a two-part process that we see from our perspective that an applicant may apply to the court through the motion process, and in that requires a fingerprint card so that we can positively identify the record that we are asked to be removing ultimately is in fact the record of the person that is applying. The motion process goes through the district attorney's office, and ultimately the judge signs the order.
That part of the process I understand.
Okay.
And I don't want to, if there are other members who don't understand that part and want to hear this piece of it, I'm trying to understand what actually happens to the records.
Right.
They're expunged, they're destroyed. How? What's that process
okay.
look like? Who does
yes,
it?
Yes, when we obtain the order to remove that record based on the information from the order, we do remove the fingerprint card and the arrest and conviction data, whichever is appropriate on the court order, from the criminal history file for which we are responsible for the state of Oregon. And ultimately, we are responsible to report that information to the FBI if it had been reported on the national level based on our relationship with the FBI and the exchange of criminal histories. Then they would also, in turn, remove it from the national level. When it's removed, it is purged from all record of anyone having access to it. The fingerprint card is destroyed. The only record that remains is within our office and is closed and only open if it's ordered by the court.
Does destroyed mean shredded?
Yes, we shred confidential.
All right,
yes.
That's what I'm trying to get. Thank you.
Madam Chair, let me have a...
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, while we have a break. Major, trying to, and maybe this is Doug too, on the big sheets we have, page 8.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having trouble with the FTEs here and reconciling them again with the page in the back of the book. If you look at the criminal justice information system, you have 3, 6, 10, 3. The 3 is below the line of not anything that doesn't correspond to anything. In the book, it says 19 positions. So that 3, where did that 3 come from? And the same thing in the bottom numbers. It doesn't match up with the page we have with the at the back of our briefing material.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, in fact, I had just gone out to the audience to ask the same question as I came across it. And I don't, whether you have an answer or Ken, the Budget Director, has an answer to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the Budget Director, Ken Weiss, just informed me he would like to address that when we're done here.
That's fine. The Madam Chair, follow up. The background checks, can you tell us, do you get reimbursed for any of the customers on page 34? The schools, the realtors, the nurses, private security, does that come back in as revenue? And even the firearms checks or something, is any of that fee, you get fees for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we are, many of our services in this section are fee-based. And we charge the fees that it takes to run those checks to the customer. For example, the handgun person that purchases a handgun is charged a fee, and we're reimbursed for that service. We currently are going through a process to adjust those fees because the funding in this section has not been adequate. The fees have not been covering the cost of providing the service. So we're going through the administrative hearing process, and there's also been some legislation introduced to increase some fees that are statutory in order to cover the cost of this for this section.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Could you, Major, could you expand on the teacher bill? Which, I mean, is that employees in the school system, the 600,000? Is that the children? Were pre-employed background checks for the teachers, okay, to assist the 6,000 children. So do we do all employees of in school, the cafeteria, the bus drivers? And
Madam Chair, Representative Winsnett, I would have to refer to the particular statute, but typically the school districts and other agencies that have access to do background checks are going to do the positions that have the potential for one-on-one contact with a child in a setting outside of a group. But each agency has a slightly different customer base or employee base that they check. But yes, those, when they deem that a fingerprint check is needed to be done, that comes through our office, and we do charge them a fee for that.
Madam Chair, follow up, please.
Yes.
Now you're saying fingerprint. I'm familiar with Commission on Children and Families. We have to do background checks on our smart readers, and it's like it's a very expensive background check. Are you not doing a full background check, just doing fingerprints on these employees, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Winsnett, the agency has the authority to determine which background checks they do. They generally have access on their own to do a name check through the criminal history system or LEDS. And I know that they do some name checks only, and they do not result in a fingerprint check done through our office. But when they do reach that point, they do send them to us. I can't tell you how many exactly.
Madam Chair, last follow-up on this item.
Oh, certainly.
Let me be sure I phrase this correctly. Anytime we have a bad apple, it reflects upon anyone that works for the government. So we've recently had several school employees that have been bad apples. Were they processed? Were they not identified in these checks? Do you know? And if you can't discuss it because of the case, I understand that, but... Now, if we're doing these checks, what's our outcome? And
Madam Chair, Representative Winsnett, I would need to have the specific individuals that you're referring to and check to see if we had done a background check. We have not been notified in any of the recent reports that I've read in the media from any of the school districts to inquire about a check that we've done. So it's likely that the check might not have been done, but I would have to check on that.
Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, my memory may be off, but I think it was approximately around the 99 session that we added classified school employees to the people that they were already had to have background checks, but we actually made it retroactive so that employees that had already been employed for a number of years had to go through a background check also. So I'm almost assured anybody that's in an employee status in a school has had a background check of some type, whether or not, a person doesn't have to have a record to commit an offense in the future. You're never going to be able to predict who's going to commit an offense in the future, but I think if we had specific examples, they can probably tell us if anything came up in those background checks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it's important to point out that we don't drive that process, that we react to the inquiries from the customers. In other words, they call it. If they don't call us and make the check isn't done. So it's a process where we have a broad range of customers in ID services, and we respond to those customers, whether it be handguns or sheriffs with concealed weapons permits or school districts or churches. And so it's, in some cases, these things are based on the criteria of the organization that is asking for the check. They make the decision on who they want to check and who they don't want to in some circumstances. So,
Madam Chair, we might refer that to someone we know that's subcommittee chair of another committee, so he can check on that as we go through phase two.
Make a note of that. Did you have another? Okay. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is in the mode of what we're at here.
All right.
These fees that are generated in the LFO report, and just it seems like there's a lot more of this kind of thing, even in employment and so on, where we're doing all these checks. Why has the criminal history portion of that fallen so significantly? What's the driver to that? I mean,
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Let me read. The fees for open records checks of criminal histories has fallen significantly in the past 2 years, contributing to the funding issue described. It's like, has that slowed down, or can you?
So, Madam Chair, since I probably wrote that,
yeah.
A little background probably is in order here. Over the last two e-boards, both I think November and January, and hopefully I got the dates right, the e-board has had to deal with this particular program because of falling revenues. Most of that falling revenue is a result of general fund cutbacks over that period when state police were cutting things. And so their revenue base has fallen significantly, both in general fund and maybe in some selected fees. I'd have to get back and check my base information for that. You will have to, as a subcommittee, deal with this. They have just, I think, made rules permanent for the fees have you filed permanent rules? I can't remember.
Temporary rules.
Temporary rules. To deal with the issue for the fees, they can change. They, as they mentioned, there is a bill dealing with the firearms-related fees and at least one other fee, I think it's expungement fee.
Expungements and concealed handgun.
Right, that have to be legislatively adopted. And what they're trying to basically do is to make this program as self-sufficient from fee revenue as they can and back out the general fund. They will still need some limited general fund because there are some groups of people, I think it's coaches is a good example, that they cannot charge a fee for, that the general fund will have to pay for. But the intent of the department, as they reported to the e-board, is to try to cover as much of this program as possible by fees. So it is an issue that you'll have to deal with in phase two.
Thank you.
I want to go back to the other question that you had, Representative. Did you want to take care of getting that answered?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I don't remember exactly what it was. I just.
Well, I think this, I would suggest to the chair that she ask Senator Devlin to be sure his education subcommittee, you know, gets an answer from the Department of Education on how, you know, how many they're checking or why they having everyone checked is having direct contact as we look at that.
That one I recall. There was a question previous to that.
Yes, ma'am. Correct. Thank you, ma'am. We're going to get that from the other gentleman about as we get later in the presentations,
right.
I think, on
okay.
the reconciling the FTEs, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Hansen and then Senator Devlin.
Well, I was thinking if we want to remind Senator Devlin, then it'd probably be better to put it in writing.
We forget from time to time.
Well, welcome back, Senator Devlin.
I will take that as a friendly suggestion from one of the more elder members of the committee. I think one of the issues here with the background checks, though, too, is that I only started in the legislature in 97. I know Senator Gordon started, I believe, in the 80s.
No, it was actually 91.
91.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in trouble now. But I think in the mid-90s, the legislature went on sort of a frenzy of requiring background checks. And some of them are really important, like the one on school employees. And I remember one in particular that caused a lot of problems, requiring background checks on real estate salespeople because, well, we could kind of make it a priority for the state police. It was really very difficult to make it a priority for the FBI to do those checks. So we did have a period of problems there. But I would make that inquiry because I think there is an interesting issue here. When we went back and said all classified employees, including existing employees, have to have a background check, I think that was done, but I'm not so sure, and I think it would be interesting information for the committee, how school districts keep aware of any offenses may be committed by an employee of the district. Because I think they do the one background check. It would be very expensive to do a background check every year on every school employee. But how do you find out, unless somebody tells you, that somebody's been charged in a county, you know, two counties away with some offense? I think it's an interesting dilemma. So I'll try to get an answer for the committee about that because I think we do one background check. I don't think we do anything on a periodic basis.
Representative Hansen.
Probably this is a good area for us to examine as a legislature because we, in human resources, we discovered that every time the Department of Human Resources employee is promoted, there's another fingerprint exercise and a background check, which seems very redundant of, you know, so trying to get some good thoughts on what the rational way to keep up in this arena without completely wasting resources with probably something that should be thoughtfully talked about.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, if you'll refer to page 35, I begin. There's a brief section that describes all four sections of the of this division, or of this section, or excuse me, this division, the mission, goal, and statutory authority. So we've already covered that information in the overview of the sections. It's provided there for you to review if you're interested. I'd like to go on and talk about service delivery of this division. Again, there are the four sections. If you refer to page 37, you will see that, for example, the enterprise services section, which again is primarily our technology computer section, they are primarily internally focused to the agency and helping us accomplish our mission across all the divisions, whether that be local area network design or desktop computers or computers used by a trooper in a patrol car or a forensic scientist in a laboratory. These this section facilitates all that support, primarily within our agency. If you move down to wireless communication, they, as I said yesterday, are responsible for the statewide law enforcement communication system. They design and maintain that, and you can see that again is primarily focused internally for our own state police operations. However, we do support other agencies, work with ODOT. We are still working with the State Fire Marshal's Office, with CSEP, Oregon Emergency Management. So we have communication crossover there with other agencies, or what's being formed now into a new agency. We continue to support them. As you move down through this, the Criminal Justice Information Services section is primarily focused outward. They provide services to the entire criminal justice system and even other states and the FBI. And then move into Identification Services section. You can see for the different sections of or different units of that section, they have different partners. For example, Firearms InstaCheck is federally licensed firearm dealers, public law enforcement agencies are the primary customers. The public fingerprinting is the public or regulatory agencies. Those different services are provided across the board depending on the need.
What I don't see is a tie-in to the Homeland Security on the right side of the chart in any of the categories.
Madam Chair, I think if you look, for example, under the wireless communication, we're still involved in providing support to the State Fire Marshal's Office, Oregon Emergency Management, and CSEP as it relates to the Office of Homeland Security.
Okay.
We're still cooperating with them. In fact, some of the efforts we talked about yesterday related to the new state, developing a new state communication system, are at least our initial thoughts are that a good place for that to be housed would be with Homeland Security as a centralized agency. So.
All right.
Page 38 begins some outcomes. This division is not does not have any formal benchmarks, but we've listed by section the internal program outcomes to give you an idea of what our expectation of each of these sections are. For example, in the enterprise services section, we want reliable, responsive, secure IT infrastructure. If you move down through wireless communication, if this section's doing their job, troopers can communicate with each other. They can receive emergency dispatch information. Command centers can communicate back and forth between each other. So those are some of the outcomes of that section. In CJIS, or the Criminal Justice Information section, you can see that law enforcement information is passed between criminal justice agencies within the state. The OUCR data is utilized to support $7 million in grant funds for agencies within the state of Oregon. Crime statistics provide law enforcement management with tools that are needed to tell whether or not they're being effective. Moving on down, ID services section that we just talked about, some of the outcomes we believe are seniors and children and vulnerable citizens of Oregon are protected through the criminal history checking process. Criminals are prevented from buying guns. We have accurate criminal histories that are maintained for use by the criminal justice agencies, and an example of that would be it's critical that the courts, for example, have accurate criminal history data when they're sentencing people. They need to know about previous criminal history, so we need to maintain accurate criminal history records. Citizens can gain police clearance for adoption, visas, employment, licensing, and certification. Moving on down the list, law enforcement and authorized regulatory agencies can gain real-time access to nationwide criminal history record information. And then the bottom one, another output or outcome is a criminal arrest in Oregon can be compared to 8 other Western states in addition to a nationwide database for enhanced identification of wanted subjects. We currently utilize a computerized system called WIN, that it's networked with the Western states that allow us to compare fingerprint across state lines. That concludes my information about Information Management Division, and I'd like to proceed with the Gaming Enforcement Division.
Madam Chair, I do know that the co-chairs would be interested in the subcommittee exploring at least to have one performance measure probably out of the ID services area in this division, given the importance in terms of customer service and those kinds of issues. So I think that would be a phase two discussion.
Absolutely. And I would ask here if the department has given thought to what that performance measure might define.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have had internal discussions recently, ongoing discussions about additional performance measures for some of the divisions within my bureau. The only division that currently has performance measures, Forensic Services Division, and we would like to increase the number of performance measures, and but we want to also make those meaningful, and we have not yet determined what those performance measures would be, but we are interested in pursuing that.
We would ask that you continue to work with Mr. Wilson as you think that through.
Madam Chair.
And Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other thought here is in the wireless part of your performance, maybe it ought to be measured in terms of the way that troopers, the folks that are actually using the system, perceive it to be, might be a useful measurement that would help management understand and these types of committees hear what they're thinking of how that system performs.
That's a good point.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, we routinely receive input from those folks, and I agree it's valuable input, and we are aware, as I mentioned yesterday, of some serious shortcomings in our communication system and are working to address that, but I appreciate that input.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Please continue.
I'd like to next move on to the Gaming Enforcement Division. The Gaming Enforcement Division, first of all, I'd like to introduce Captain Bob Sundstrom, who is the director of the Gaming Enforcement Division. The Gaming Enforcement Division consists of two primary gambling regulatory sections. We have the Lottery Security Section and the Tribal Gaming Section. And these sections are responsible for providing oversight and regulatory investigations related to gambling within the state of Oregon, both through the lottery and through the tribal gaming centers. In addition, we also have the executive director of the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission working within this division, although I would like to point out that in the governor's 0507 recommended budget, this position, as well as the general fund dollars, have been eliminated from the budget, although the statutory requirement to provide this service continues to exist. The primary purpose of the Gambling Enforcement Division is to provide independent and specialized gambling and regulatory services to the Oregon State Lottery and to enforce the tribal compacts related to gambling with the Oregon Native American tribes. These functions ensure that there is fairness and integrity and security and honesty in the operation of legalized gambling in Oregon. The primary purpose of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission as it currently exists is to protect the interests of athletes and the public related to medical standards and fraud and fairness in boxing and wrestling events. The lottery section itself is made up of three units. There's the security unit, which is made up of seven security specialists, and then there are two sworn investigative units that are located geographically around the state based on where we need those folks to be working. The units work together to prevent and detect crimes and rule violations and provide vendor and lottery employees vendor investigations. This section, for example, will travel to various vendors of gaming machines and will do background and regulatory investigations relating to make sure those companies are on the up and up and are not connected to organized crime. The tribal gaming section also provides the same type of vendor investigations as it relates to the tribal gaming casinos.
Major, regarding the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, the governor's budget takes out the one position, the executive director, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Are there remaining enforcement issues that we should be aware of, be concerned about in this arena, so to speak?
Madam Chair, I'll defer to Captain Sundstrom on that.
Okay. Madam Chair, member of the committees, my name is Bob Sundstrom, captain of the Gaming Enforcement Division. The Boxing and Wrestling Commissioner, or Director, is a state police employee, non-sworn position. We have a five-member, volunteer member commission, which has a chair. And these are non-sworn people, or volunteers from around the state. In this unit, you definitely do need somebody to oversee the boxing and wrestling events that occur around the state. We're seeing more and more events coming to the state, specifically because of this mixed martial arts, ultimate fighting, that has become very popular. We're seeing one or to two events a month in just that in that type of ring sport. We've only experienced a very limited amount of boxing events in Oregon over the last couple years, usually two a year, and that's held at Seven Feathers Casino. I know our director is meeting with some promoters now to try to bring in more boxing events into the state. Wrestling, as you know, the last legislative session took away the, we call it entertainment wrestling, the authority to regulate them because it's entertainment wrestling. The outcome is predetermined. So what we oversee in entertainment wrestling is a promoter has to be licensed, and then they have to provide an affidavit that the fighters are free of blood-borne pathogens, and then they have to pay a 6% tax on gross receipts to the state.
I'm reading the text on at the top of page 40, which indicates that the primary purpose of the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission is to protect the interests of the athletes and the public concerning medical standards, fairness, financial fraud, and event environmental safety. By federal statute, all professional boxing must be overseen by a state commission. Do we have the capacity to do what we're supposed to be doing by federal statute? Are we meeting that standard?
Right now we are because we have the commission in place. But if we do not have the commission in place, then what the state would have to do if they want a boxing event here, they would have to ask for another state's commission to come in to this state to oversee that particular event.
In the absence of an executive director, who oversees the commission?
Well, we wouldn't have that. Would just fall to me.
And your capacity to take on that piece of work?
That position is a full-time position, and we it would be very difficult to do.
Please continue.
Back to the lottery security section, the three units, again, we have the security unit and two sworn investigative units. They function together, and they provide proactive enforcement measures to protect and detect crimes and rule violations regarding the Oregon Lottery. Moving on to the tribal gaming section, we are under obligations in the current tribal state compacts. We have entered into agreements with the tribes to provide specialized gambling oversight. We do monitoring, vendor, contractor investigations, and some specialized oversight at the tribal gaming centers. And this, again, is intended to ensure that there's integrity and security and honesty, so forth, within the tribal gaming centers. The regulations and rules that are enforced in, by this section have been agreed to in the tribal compact process. There are nine Native American tribes in Oregon that have gaming compacts with the state, and all nine do have gaming centers in operation around the state. So we have detectives assigned geographically and assigned to specific casinos to provide those functions. Again, Captain Sundstrom, moving on to boxing and wrestling. Captain Sundstrom already gave an overview of boxing and wrestling as it currently exists. But they, again, are intended to help regulate and protect the interests of the athletes and the public. And the commission, as I understand it, under the law, will continue to exist. They have a small general fund budget to deal with some of their expenses. I understand that money would be gone. The commission would still continue to have authority, but would not have that general fund resource, and there would be no assistance of the executive director, since that position no longer would exist.
We have a question from Representative Lisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it's to Doug. I would like to know more about the contracts that they're negotiating. I don't understand why the captain's position and the contracting positions aren't charged against these services. Why the general fund's paying for this captain's salary and the contracting people, and that should all be under this program and be paid back by the lottery and the gambling casino. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the captain's position is paid for by these.
Okay, the numbers don't match again. And then your statement down here says requires contracting services. So some of the positions in the overhead are providing the contractor overseeing some way this operation, if I'm correct. Because I'm assuming all these FTEs are officers, licensed officers, that are going in and checking. They're not operating out of the office, or am I wrong?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, all the positions in this section, with the exception of partial payment of the director and the commission, are other funds. The tribal gaming, the tribes pay all the tribal gaming sections costs, and the lottery pays all the lottery sections costs. I believe in the 0305 budget process, I believe it was like $83,000 or $85,000 of general fund dollars to the boxing and wrestling unit. The rest was other funds. In the 0507, I think we had requested about $98,000 or $99,000, and that's what was eliminated, as well as some of the general fund dollar, which is very small, to that paid for the commissioner's expenses.
We got, Madam Chair, I'd like to have more information on that to see if, I think it's a service we have to provide, as we've said, by statute, but they should pay their weight, the full weight, and anything we can charge them, I want to charge them to.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, there is no general fund in this division in the governor's budget.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding of the financing of the sort of the division leadership, including the captain, is
offset or is charged against the tribal contracts and the lottery contracts. My worry is if he starts spending more time on boxing and wrestling more than the $78,000, which is what they project the revenue to be for just for that program, is that he'll start spending between the commission's costs and his time, it will be greater than $78,000, and then we have another issue that we're charging too much. We're charging for services to the tribes and the to the lottery for things that they aren't, for functions that they should not be paying for.
Thank you. So we can focus on that.
We'll have to focus on
that.
You bet. You bet. We'll definitely
Madam Chair, Representative Wisdom, I think it's important to point out that the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, it wouldn't be appropriate to charge those services off to either lottery or tribal gaming because they're not related.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we get a number somewhere from of how much revenue is generated by the 6% wrestling fee? And now that goes to the general fund? Or is that the $78,000?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, so far in this biennium, and this figure I think is 2 months old, we have generated about $115,000. That includes the 6% tax on gross receipts as well as licensing fees that we collect. We are predicting by the end of June we should bring in about $150,000. Where that goes, I don't know.
Okay, does that go, is that general fund or does it go to the commission, support the commission?
I don't know. That's the expenses, what they pay in, and I don't know where that money goes to.
We can get an answer on that question.
Thank you, ma'am.
Continue, please.
Statutory authority is outlined on page 41, and moving into the service delivery for the lottery security section, the department personnel here provide day-to-day security services to the director of the commission and provide our services delivery to the state lottery. They conduct examinations and backgrounds of all prospective employees, lottery game retailers, lottery vendors, and lottery contractors. They also provide physical security for all the lottery facilities and conduct criminal investigations if those things occur related to the lottery. Moving on to the boxing and wrestling, of course, our services are provided primarily to the Native American tribes under the negotiated compact agreements. Again, we provide those independent investigations of all of the same parties that function in the gaming environment. We, again, do independent investigations of gaming vendors and management officials, as well as conducting some criminal investigations that occur related to tribal gaming. We've already discussed the Boxing and Wrestling Commission as it relates to the full-time executive director and the five members, and their again, their customer or service delivery is intended to protect the participants involved in these events as well as the general public. We have a number of informal performance outcomes for this division. Both the lottery security section and the tribal gaming section monitor their turnaround time on reports, vendor investigation reports that they do to make sure that those are being done in a timely fashion. Both sections have a standard of making sure those investigations are conducted within 60 days. If you notice on page 43, the first graph indicates that we nearly have 100% compliance in completing those lottery vendor investigations within the 60-day period.
How many vendors does that represent?
Madam Chair, I'll have to get that information for you.
Mm-hmm. You may have it here.
Okay.
And,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in 1999, 2001, there was 56 vendor investigations. In 2001, 2003, there were 96 vendor investigations. And in 2003, 2005, there were 27 vendor investigations.
And between 01-03 and 03-05, a decrease in capacity to conduct investigations, staff capacity?
Madam Chair, in the lottery section, we have one detective that's specifically assigned to do vendor investigations, but when we get when we have to do a lot of them, we pull all the detectives in from the lottery division to assist on those investigations.
Madam Chair, unlike other divisions within the state police, this one, since it does have a dedicated funding source from the contracts, hasn't seen the staff cutbacks as things like patrol and forensics and some of those.
Okay.
Again, if you refer you to page 44 and the performance objectives for timely vendor investigations for the tribal gaming section, and again, they are at about 96%. I think it's important to point out to the committee that these investigations can be extremely complex and extensive. In some cases, they require out-of-country travel to the vendors, out-of-state travel to the vendors, and can take a significant amount of time and energy to provide these investigations. They're not simple investigations because they require a look deep into a corporation to make sure that the corporation is above board.
Again, whenever you present percentages, if you could also display the numbers behind the percentages, it gives a more complete picture.
Madam Chair, in the tribal gaming section, in 2004, we had 24 vendor investigations. In 2003, 30. 2002, 33. 2001, 35. I want to continue on and go back to 1997.
That information is helpful. It gives me a feel for the environment. Okay. Please continue.
That concludes the presentation as it relates to the gaming division. I'd like to move on to the final division of the Bureau, and that's the Human Resource Services Division.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. The governor's one recommended, he's got 41 FTEs. You're asking 42. Is that the commissioner's position?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I thought we were asking for... Yeah, there's 41 positions that the governor's recommended budget, and so it would be 42 counting the director.
The commissioner's position.
The director of the Boxing Wrestling Unit.
So he's cutting out, the governor's cutting out one position?
Yes, sir.
Why? They're paying for it.
Currently there's some general fund dollars that go to that, to pay for that position.
No. Madam Chair, that's what I'm saying. I don't know why, because why can't gaming... And I guess we can talk about that in phase two, but I don't understand why gaming, because if we don't have the director, they're going to pick that up from another position where the state's paying for it.
I think there's clarification coming forward.
Okay.
Momentarily.
I think I got distracted for a moment. I'm going to regain my thoughts. The general fund has been cut for that position. There is a discussion that can be had at phase two about the revenue that is being collected, which would be other funds that we're at this point not sure where that revenue goes, but that revenue may, in fact, there could be a discussion that may, in fact, cover that boxing wrestling director's position, and it would be paid for. Right now, what's been removed from the budget is the general fund portion that covers that position.
Let me check something. The people sitting immediately behind you, do you have something to add to this conversation? You appear to want to jump into this. Please come up and help us unpack this. Just reading your body language.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ken Weiss, Budget Director, and I apologize for the animated reaction back there. The gaming division consisted of 42 positions for the 2001-2003 biennium, 2003-2005 biennium, the current biennium we're in. In that division, there was about $98,000 of general fund. That general fund supported about 67%, about two-thirds, of the salary of the boxing and wrestling director and some per diem for the boxing and wrestling commission. That money was removed from the budget at the governor's rec level. The general fund was of $98,000. And the full position authority, even though we do still have about 33% of the revenues generated from boxing and wrestling activity that would support that salary. We think that there's going to be enough revenue generated within the boxing and wrestling program that maybe in working with legislative fiscal and budget management, we might be able to determine that we do have enough money to maybe support the salary of the boxing and wrestling if this committee chooses to restore it. The dollars that are collected do stay with the program, and that they end up as ending balance and carryover dollars for the following biennium.
Okay.
Madam Chair, in terms of some history, this program has always had trouble being self-sufficient, going back a number of years and being able to generate the revenues, in part because of the activity of boxing, in general, I think has gone down or gone up and down over the years, and the wrestling issues also. So it has been a revenue problem for a number of years.
I'm still having the trouble with the numbers, Doug. If the division director is paid for with general funds, my argument still is that should be, we could get that out of the other services, or at least all but the wrestling.
Madam Chair, if I may, the captain's salary is paid 50% from the lottery contract and 50% from tribal gaming.
It is.
The only general fund that is in that division was the $98,000 in the boxing and wrestling program.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I think there may be some confusion between the division director and the executive director of the boxing and wrestling.
Right. That
may be where the confusion
Thank
is.
You.
Thank you so much for helping us get that straight.
The next division is the Human Resource Services Division, and I think it's important to point out that this could be better named as our Business Services Division. It's not simply just Human Resources. It contains various component programs of the agency, such as the Office of the Superintendent, Professional Standards, Budget and Financial Services, and Personnel. This division also contains six administrative programs that I'll talk about shortly. I will briefly describe for you some of the different sections or break out some of the different sections of this division. For example, the Office of the Superintendent is located within the budget of the Human Resource Services Division. Of course, the Superintendent's office is made up of the Superintendent, two Lieutenant Colonels, and one support person, and they obviously provide leadership and administrative oversight and set policy for the entire agency. The Office of Budget and Finance is within this division, and that section or portion of the budget is broken into two sections. We have the Budget Services section that is responsible for preparing, monitoring, implementing the department's budget. And we also have Financial Services section, which is responsible for budget execution, contract administration, and grant administration.
Let me ask a question here. When was the most recent audit of the Oregon State Police?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure any specific audits are part of the statewide audit that's done every while, but I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and look at specific audits on specific programs. Ken may know more. Mr. Weiss.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Ken Weiss. The Secretary of State's audit practice in the last couple of years have been subject matter audits. For example, they may have a payroll issue, and they'll randomly select or use some criteria to select which agencies they'll come and audit, and they issue what I call topic audit reports, and they tend to group these subjects or these agencies' activities into a single audit that way. As we are included in those audits, we will include the report and our response in the budget document itself. And it seems to me that my recollection is we probably have been subject to, I think, three in the current biennium, and they were tied primarily to payroll-related items. We do have a Major 66 audit of all agencies that received a Major 66 lottery funds that we I think that's a biennial audit, too. We don't have a report on that one. The Secretary of State has completed the audit, and we didn't, as I understand it, we didn't have any findings.
I'd like to have a summary of the audits for Phase 2, Mr. Wilson. Thank you.
Moving through the division, one thing I'd like to point out to the committee is that I will talk here a lot about units and sections within this division. What I don't want to leave you with the impression is that we have a significant number of staff here, because we don't. Most of our units within this division are one person. We really don't have any redundancy in this division is understaffed in many areas, in many critical oversight areas. And I'll try to talk about a little bit of that as I go through the overview.
Senator Devlin, did you have a question?
I just wanted to comment, Madam Chair. I believe Doug could comment, and probably Representative Hansen also, that during the previous session we made a lot of cuts in this area, actually. So the only question I actually had is, and I don't want to perk up the superintendent's ears back there, but I've heard anecdotal evidence of troopers doing clerical duty because of shortages in this division. Are those anecdotes true, or are they false?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, obviously the superintendent will be speaking shortly and can address this further, but some of those some of that information is accurate. We do have people doing a lot of different things because we don't have the adequate staff to do the job. We simply don't. A lot of people are doing everything from changing headlights on patrol cars to doing a lot of different administrative things that if we had more support, we would not have to do.
Please excuse me. I need to testify on it, Bill. Please excuse me. I'll return just as soon as I can.
Please proceed.
The Office of Professional Standards is within this division, and this reports directly to the superintendent's office and provides oversight function across the entire agency. For example, the Internal Investigation Unit, which consists of one inspector, investigates internal personnel matters as well as internal criminal investigations. As I said, it was staffed by one inspector and is overseen by the director or captain of the Office of Professional Standards. The Risk Management Unit, which again is staffed by one person, and this person is responsible for managing our risk within the agency. It's also the DOJ contact, for example, deals with all our lawsuits, tort claims, works with our safety coordinator to try to minimize risk, and it's also the agency gatekeeper with DOJ to make sure that we spend our DOJ funds properly and are asking for advice one time and not asking the same question over and over again. The training section is also within the Office of Professional Standards. They're responsible for recruiting, selecting, training the sworn workforce, responsible for training all the department employees. And when I talk about that, I'm talking about the ongoing mandatory training that's done. Especially our sworn staff, are required to have regular mandatory training in high-risk areas such as firearms and defensive tactics. They are currently staffed by a lieutenant and two troopers in one clerical position. Just for some historical perspective, our training division used to be a division headed by a captain and a much more extensive staff, but it's been reduced down now to essentially four people. And like I mentioned, they oversee all mandatory training for the department, including running our recruit schools when we have those recruit schools. There are five administrative programs within this division which are overseen by the division director. These five programs include personnel services, payroll, procurement, fleet management, and safety workers' compensation. The personnel section, as you know, is responsible for keeping records and doing personnel work for approximately 1,000 employees. They recruit all the non-sworn professional staff for the agency. They do record management of our physical files and of all the computerized files, interact heavily with the Department of Administrative Services and our payroll section. The personnel director also oversees our labor relations unit, again, which is staffed with one person. Our labor relations manager is responsible for negotiating labor contracts, day-to-day administration of the labor contracts, as well as handling grievances and arbitrations and those types of matters. The personnel section currently is staffed with two employees. The payroll unit is staffed with two employees and one manager. They provide all payroll and benefit administration for all the eight employees on the agency. They also work closely with personnel and labor relations on matters related to payroll. Our procurement section is made up of two employees, and they're responsible for the acquisition and distribution of services and supplies across the agency. They run our agency stock room. They're the agency purchasing agent. And as I said, they are staffed with two employees. They also handle our surplus property. We have fleet management and central install. For your information, this function is operationally overseen by the patrol division captain. However, the budget and purchasing is still handled by the division director of this Human Resource Services Division. Our central install section prepares and maintains all the agency's fleet. They deal with the new patrol cars. They put the equipment on the new cars and take the equipment off the old cars and handle the surplus function related to fleet. We also have a safety workers' compensation unit, which is made up of one person. She handles all of our safety-related matters and worker compensation issues for the entire agency. Basically, keeps her finger in the dike and handles those things as they come in. Other services that the division is responsible for is the oversight of our facilities across the state, which includes leases. They approve our intergovernmental agreements, review those personal services contracts, prepare and provide oversight for purchase orders. There's also two command centers within the division budget, and these are our communication or dispatch centers, one located here in Salem, one located in Central Point. These centers provide 24-hour dispatch services for the entire state police operation, and as we talked earlier, we'll also provide cooperation and assistance to some of our partners, such as ODOT, continue to work with the Fire Marshal, OEM, and CSEP. We also fund programs such as the agency SWAT team out of this division as well. Without any other questions, I'd like to say that this concludes my presentation about the Support Services Bureau. I would like to, with your permission, just briefly summarize and conclude by saying that each one of the divisions within this bureau are staffed by some very dedicated employees. In no situation do I believe we have more staff than we need. They really believe in what they're doing and are dedicated to doing their part to protect the citizens of the state. And whether that be one of our communication techs that works out on a mountaintop repeater, whether it be Dr. Gunson who performs autopsies, one of the employees in our handgun insta-check section, a payroll tech that processes a trooper's paycheck, or a scientist who reviews a rape suspect case, they all play an essential role in protecting the public. They're all essential. Without these support functions, we're not able to protect the integrity of the agency and protect the citizens of the state. And I'd just like to thank you for your time and your attention.
Any additional questions for the manager? Hearing none. Thank you very much. Doug, what's the next item on the agenda?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Weiss is going to come up and go through, review the priority sheets, the large sheets that you were given, to make sure that you have a handle on those and respond to your questions, maybe go over some of the 10% reduction that were required in the process, and then close up with some closing comments by the superintendent. I do have some replacement pages, some minor changes that Mr. Weiss gave me for the larger priority sheets. They're numbered, so you can just replace the pages.
Got it.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Ken Weiss, Budget Director. First, I'd like to begin on this large 11 by 17 set of papers that you have by pointing out a couple of corrections. I think Representative Wisnik pointed out earlier and corrected. So there were a couple of errors when we first crafted this report. On page 8 of 12, back on the Information Management Division, we did, when we went through this initial accounting, we did leave some positions hanging down without program assignments. I've since then have some corrections, and what I'd like to do is when we come back at PACE, it'll give you a fresh document that's current, because also you're going to find a couple of typos on this document, and we want to clean all of that up. But if I may, on page 8, under the second major program list, that criminal justice information system, the first group, LEDGE unit, shows a 3. That number should be 6, both the 6 on the positions and under the FTE column. That will account for those 3 positions down below that's unassigned in that section. The next section, identification services, there's going to be several changes here. What we're trying to do is adjust those 23 positions that are dangling down below without program assignment. So the new assignments are CCH. We'll have 21 positions and FTE instead of 4. AFIS unit will have 13 positions, 13 FTE instead of the 19 figure and that 18.7578. No change in regulatory unit of 17. And then the last change in the firearms unit, instead of 10, will be 22 positions, 22 FTE. The last change is the enterprise services section has a position down below that's dangling. That one should be moved up one notch to the data entry. So data entry will be 5 positions, 5 FTE instead of the 4. And we apologize for the error.
First change that you gave, which I believe was public criminal justice.
The first change in the criminal justice information services is LEDGE unit currently shows 3 positions, 3 FTE. That number should be 6, and that will eliminate that that bottom 3.
Thank you. Please proceed.
The handout that we first of all, I'd like to have Stacey Marr kind of walk you through just briefly how these forms were put together in the first place, and then I'll pick it up after that.
For the record, my name is Stacey Marr. I'm the finance manager for State Police. Of the 3 pages that were handed out to you today, I just want to briefly describe the process of preparing the agency prioritization schedule and the reduction options. First, we went to the divisions and requested each division to identify their program areas and allocate the governor's recommended budget to each of those program areas. With that information, the leadership committee consolidated that information and identified 5 criteria for establishing priorities of each of these programs. Page 2 of the 3 that were handed out to you today represents all the programs of the agency in priority order from 1 to 24 with the identified criteria in the far left column under the principal. Page 2 also indicates that there's a 10% reduction column. It's column number 15 towards the right side of the document. That is assuming that there would be a 10% reduction taken across the board to all program areas in the agency. Page 1 represents the consolidative reductions that are actually being submitted by the agency for legislative consideration. And Ken Weiss will.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the clerical changes that we made to numbers and so on, but where you have changed budget numbers, would you reflect on those changes on the new pages, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Hannah. What we did was we took some of these program pieces and we rolled them together. If they were reflecting, for example, under patrol, several different individual contracts, we simply lumped them together and rolled the dollars into a roll-up figure.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Well, I'm just looking at patrol, and it's the same number, $66,435,913. And I haven't had time to look at the whole thing, but just as an example, training went from a general fund number of $1,150,000 to $1,051,000.
Correct. Madam Chair, if I may address that, that was a number that I needed to correct from the original document, and I think that's there's two dollar number changes on the revised paper that we just handed out. Training is a subset of the human resources. And when we did the criminal fines and assessment adjustment from the governor's recommended figure, I mistakenly put an erroneous figure in for training originally, and the number that's on this page we just handed out is the correct figure. So to make the division balanced, though, I had to have an offsetting. I think it's about $97,000 difference. So training went down about this $97,000, and the human resource component of it went up about $97,000. So the division as a whole continued to stay balanced for allocation purposes. But that's helpful.
Please continue. And what page are you?
I think Madam Chair, Representative Hannah is talking about page 2.
Okay.
Where the total program budget for training, which, let me get my bearings here, item number 9, that figure on the page that we just passed out is now $1,051,174. And that's a corrected number from an earlier, from the original packet I gave you, which was 1.15. I don't know what it was. I can't remember the old number. And so the corresponding adjustment would be up under the number 3 program, Human Resources, that has an $18,993,000 general fund figure. That figure also changed by a like amount so that the total division stays balanced.
Madam Chair, could I just...
Certainly.
I want to be honest. This is something I ask about, and so I'm voicing my concern here, that we have a brand-new facility for training, and it concerned me in the beginning that we were not able within the state police to utilize or get all the training we needed through that new facility. And I'm concerned about the amount of money we've spent on that facility. And so to come back and move money out of training to out of that bucket and into human resources is a concern to me. And I'd like you to explain to this committee a little clearer what the error was from when it was there to when it wasn't there.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I'll admit I just simply made an error. I picked up the wrong number when I was going through making these adjustments. I began with the human resources total budget. I was making an allocation myself, and I just made an error in my calculations. And the numbers that you have in front of you now are the numbers that we put in budget, and those are the numbers that were in there from the governor's direct figure.
Chair. Representative Hanna, I think I may have brought this to attention, that training number, because I knew what the training number was, because it used to be a dedicated source of funding through criminal fines and assessment. I brought that to Mr. Reese's attention. I think that may have prompted his moves to go back and check the numbers. So that 1,000 or 1,051 or whatever it is on the new sheet, we used to be funded through criminal fines and assessment, but now in the governor's budget, all that CFA money was transferred to general fund, and that's why it was real identifiable as a number.
Is that satisfactory?
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
If understanding Representative Hanna's frustration, just a comment on our new process in terms of this budget process. I think there are benefits to it, but there's a negative in the sense of the prior time when we went through these agencies in the prior session, we had all this documentation in front of us. And if you wanted to check something, you just looked through the book and you found it. And we don't have a lot of that background in this phase one. And so I think there's a plus to this and there's a negative too.
Okay. But we do have Mr. Wilson, don't we? very fortunately. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'd like to do now is to take you to page one of this packet, and that's really where we get down to the exercise of identifying where this agency would take its 10% reductions by fund to reach a grand total of the $23,078,000, which was the overall target. Now, as Stacy indicated in her review, the 10% figure listed on page two was simply it was an indicator for us to say, if we chose to use across the board, that is where those reductions and the amounts of dollars those reductions would occur. But after we completed the prioritization and took a look at our principles in which we ranked these programs, we concluded that we weren't going to follow the across the board method. We were going to make some pretty tough decisions. So some of these program areas that have reductions are substantially higher than 10%, but they're where the leadership team felt that if we had to make these reductions, these are the program areas, these are the dollar amounts, and these are the FTEs that we would make these cuts in from an agency's standpoint. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I can begin walking us through number 1 through 24. Because they're in priority order, my presumption, of course, is that we're going to, the lowest priority would be the first ones cut, and maybe that's the most rational way to walk through this, or we can do it from the top down, either way.
I wouldn't make an assumption.
Okay.
I would just walk us through the information that you just...
Essentially, do not make any cuts in the department program areas for programs with priority number 1 through 4. The first cut that shows up from the top down, remember this would be the last program that we would recommend cutting, but in a top down order, the first one that we'll discuss would be the forensics identifications program. This makes up about half of that entire division. The reason that the cut is so heavy in the forensics division is with the target of $9.6 million of general fund of the budget's 10%, the forensics division finds itself showing up on this list with some reductions. That $1.5 million would involve about 14 positions. I do have the program folks here to talk specifically about what these impacts would mean, but what I tried to do is just capture just a couple of comments to reflect on what these reductions would mean. In this program area here, we'd have more restrictive triage priority guidelines. I think you heard a little bit about that yesterday, where they've implemented a set of guidelines that helps them decide which cases are going to work or they can work with the staff they have. If they had to take these cuts, they would have to revisit that priority triage and those guidelines, make them more restrictive and probably have an impact of increasing their backlog and slow down their turnaround time.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ken, would you help me so that I understand? If we look at forensics on this page and there's more than one line item, and we want to go back and do the math and say what, you know, before you get there or as you're going through, what percent of total forensics are we going to, are these tied together, or because there's different segments in forensics, how will we know which section it came from? Is there an identifier, a way to know that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I think the best way that I, that at least worked for me when we were working through these sheets, I had to go back to essentially for forensics specifically to page 9. And that's their total budget with each of their programs identified. And then from that area, we broke their basic forensics discipline. Now, again, this, I apologize for this, but what you have is the old set. And we actually broke forensics into two major program areas. And on that one, you're going to see that this forensics identification program has about $11 million in it and about 51 positions in it. And then you're going to go on down to the next forensics program that's on this priority list, and you're going to find the other, which is number 11, is going to be the other $1.5 million and another 15 positions. And the only third piece of the forensics is that implied consent, which has about $199,000 about $1.2 million in that total program, about six positions. So I think I empathize with you, Representative. This set of worksheets here, because it's been changed and consolidated, is not going to be an easy one to work with, but the replacement ones, I think, will make it very clear the numbers.
Let me jump in here just for a moment, Representative Hannah, bear with me. I know that the superintendent wants to comment toward the end of this hearing, and you're going to need about 10 minutes or so. So that's going to give us about 15 minutes to get through what would really be a summary of these 24 items. The detail behind each of these items we're going to get into in phase two. I'm not cutting Representative Hannah off at all at this point. I want him to continue to pursue his question, just so you know how we're budgeting time for the rest of the afternoon.
Chair, I'll be particularly cognizant of that, but I have it's confusing.
Yes, it
could
is.
You look, please, Ken, at page 2, which is the agency-wide. There's about 4 lines down for forensics, identification forensics. You have $11,429,890, and then on down on the 11th item down below is forensics again in the identical number. Are those the same thing?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, no, they are not. We took what we originally defined as basic forensics, all disciplines, indistinguishable, and concluded that we really needed to break that into two programs. So the forensics division director decided to break that into two equal programs. One he calls identification forensics, and he put half of his $22 million in that one. And then the general forensics program, he put the other half. So they are not the same. They are. The intention was to split that $22 million into two programs so that, I think, frankly,
The reason for that was for ranking orders. We've concluded that there are some things that they do in forensics that can be separated into two separate program areas rather than one large single one for the most part.
Thank you. I'm done. I can make it total now.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
Cognizant of your issue of time, I think this is the general understanding, but it's just a little bit of an awkward way to look at this. Although there's not much in general funds till you get up to that level. What you're listing here is your 24th item would be the first item that you would cut if you had to cut, and your first item would be the last item that you'd have to cut.
Please continue.
Again, we can talk about each particular item if you'd like, or in the interest of time, I can just generally tell you the programs as we've called them out, and you can look at the dollars. Some of the programs only have, for example, other funds in it or federal funds, and there was no. Let me just jump down to number 22 under HIDA program. Our target for the general fund and our federal fund agency-wide was only $776,000. Of these programs that have federal funds, the impact there, for example, is just of that money that passes through to the counties, we would reduce that program by $776,000. The HIDA program has about $5.4 million overall in the program, and most of that passes through to the counties. There's some dollars that we cover the three staff and some overhead that we retain.
You're going to need to say more later about what the impact would be of reducing grant funds to local counties. It's more than just a reduction of dollars. There's an actual impact on the ground in terms of enforcement. So you'll need to be more specific later.
And Madam Chair, we do have staff in the audience that would be willing to talk to that if we had the time to do that.
We'll do it in phase two.
I guess I would, again, be more focused on just to help making sure you understand how this one single sheet works. We had targets at the bottom. These totals at the bottom is the targeted amount based on our total $230 million budget by fund. The lottery funds, we only have two divisions that have lottery funds, and it was Patrol Division and the Fish and Wildlife Division. So we didn't have a whole lot of choice except to land in those two divisions to make those reductions. The other comment I would make on the other fund accounts, most of the other funds that we collect are contract dollars. So if any reductions were made in any of these other fund programs, the dollars that aren't going to be left on the table here as a savings from the state police, what is going to happen is the people that pay us those dollars are going to be the ones that have the money left on the table.
Mm-hmm.
We just simply wouldn't spend the money or have the staff to do the work.
The dignitary protection. Let's see. Is that the governor's?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Is that the governor's protective staff, or what is that?
Under number
19.
Dignitary protection, yes, for the most part, as I understand it, we have officers that are assigned to protect various dignitary activities, including the governor.
Session.
Senator Devlin.
And Madam Chair, I'm assuming it includes the building here during session, and maybe not during session also, but you had some limited staff here when we're not in session.
That group number 19, if I may, includes the Capitol Mall contract, which is a contract from the legislative admin to provide security within the Capitol building. We have a Department of Administrative Services contract to protect the employees on the mall area and the buildings. And in addition to that, we provide dignitary protection to specific dignitaries, for example, the governor. So that grouping there is several different program activities.
Are there any further questions or comments about these program units? Okay.
I do have one.
Senator Devlin.
Just to get a clear understanding of, you know, most of the identified cuts in general funds are either in forensics or they're in criminal investigations. I mean, if you're talking dollars of any size. If I have to examine a drug sample, is that general forensics? And if I have to examine a fingerprint, would that be the identification forensics, or what would be the general? How could you describe both?
Madam Chair, if I may, I'm going to have to defer to program. I don't feel I'm qualified to answer that question. May I?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is David Schmerbach, the Forensics Division Director, and you are correct, Senator Devlin. Identification forensics are anything that we do that helps identify a person, DNA, fingerprints, and the like. Everything else, general forensics, works to identify, in your example, a compound or a drug. So that's the difference between the two types.
Or a paint chip or something like that.
That is correct.
Okay. Madam Chair, for the record, it's going to be a cold day somewhere before I vote for any cuts in forensics in this budget.
Well, I don't think it'll be a cold day in Oregon, so. Okay. We're on notice. Thank you, sir.
Madam Chair, with your permission, what I'd like to do to conclude is just kind of point you down to some key points on this page. The total figures as target dollars by fund are indicated at the bottom of this worksheet. There's about 120 employee positions that would be impacted if all of these positions were, or all of these programs were reduced accordingly to hit the 10% mark. And then I just again point out to the square box there that lists our principles from A to E, that we thought worked really well in terms of the criteria that we used to do our ranking and to make the decisions that we made on where we would make these cuts if we absolutely had to. Mm-hmm. I think we all internally at least would agree that this is one agency that can't really take any cuts given the resources we have to meet the challenges it faces.
We understand your position clearly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Superintendent, please join us. And good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Ron Ricker, Superintendent of the State Police. I'd just like to make a couple of closing comments, if I might, to the committee. A little bit about a context of the State Police and where we have been as an organization since the early 80s. And most notably since the early 90s, including during that part of the 90s in which the state was enjoying its most robust economy probably in the history of the state. And within that time frame, and certainly continuing since then, the Department of State Police, with the exception of the Forensic Services Division, which has remained intact and in fact has grown over the years, the rest of the department, as a rule, has been reduced and reduced and reduced. And I mention that because I think it's important the committee understand a little bit about who we are as an organization. You've talked about, and members have commented, committee members have commented back to us about the cuts in, for example, the Human Resources Division of the department. And if you're going to set up an organization like the State Police today, no one would stand up an organization with this amount of infrastructure or this little amount of infrastructure. The only reason it continues to work is because we have those that remain after all of these cuts are people who just absolutely refuse to let the fiscal crisis of the state and of the department get in the way of the accomplishment of the mission. They're experienced people. They've been there a long time. They care about the organization, and they're just not going to let stuff fall between the cracks if they have any control over it. That's the only reason that we can continue to operate an organization like ours one in which there is considerable risk, both from the personal security standpoint and, just as importantly, from the liability standpoint associated with our business. The fact that we are who we are and the people that work over there just are not going to let it fail is the only reason it holds together, and I hope the committee will in time. I think you do appreciate that, but it's going to come out more and more as we get into phase two and beyond. I wanted to comment a little bit about training also. It's come up quite a bit in these phase one conversations, and I think it's important to try to also put that into a context. Training means a lot of things in the state police and probably in law enforcement generally, or any agency for that matter, but within policing it pretty much means one of two general things. The first thing it means is basic police officer training. And that is the part in which we will be joining hand in hand with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to accomplish, in partnership with them, that part of the basic police training that they can help provide. It's not going to be all. We've talked about our 22 equivalent weeks to their 16. We're going to do all we can with them. They do not have the capacity to take on the length of a police academy that the state police has historically run. And I don't think anyone is interested in seeing that academy be, the state police recruit training program be degraded in order to back up to that which DPSST could provide. Our partners don't want that. The citizens don't want that. I don't think the legislature wants that, and certainly we don't want that. We're going to do all we can with them. Having said that, there's the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training conducts basic police training. They also conduct certain management level training, basic supervisor's course, mid-management training, etc. But they do not provide for any law enforcement agency in the state that I'm aware of all of anybody's training needs. Not ongoing firearms qualification, what we call EVOC, emergency vehicle operations training, first aid, recertifications every year. All that kind of training that goes on is not going to be done by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for the state police, nor could it be. Some of that training is agency specific, because the training is the training, but it's also done in the context of every police agency's operating procedures and protocols. So sometimes this is very discipline specific training, and there isn't, it's not realistic to think that we could send people from Baker City that need to qualify on the range or participate in some kind of training that relates to their job in Baker City that gets done today in Baker City by people that are already there, that we would send them over here to the Valley to run them through some kind of a training course at the new academy. The new academy isn't going to be able to do that. So I just think there's a lot to talk about in training. Again, if you're going to set up an agency to be staffed according to what its own internal needs are, you wouldn't put a four-person unit of training like we have for a 1,000-plus employee organization. We've got a lieutenant, a couple of troopers that coordinate some of the training, and a clerical person, a professional employee, and these people process applications and recruitments and whatnot. And again, that is a very agency-specific kind of program. And the money that's in our budget that is general fund, that used to be CFAA money, just is a drop in the bucket compared to what it really requires to keep the workforce of the state police trained and proficient in the areas in which they need to be kept trained and proficient. So, again, I understand and agree with the committee's interest that we do all we can do with DPSST and the new academy, and we will. It's just that it isn't going to come close to being all of our training, and I don't know how it ever could be.
Can I pick up on your example of the firearms training?
Yes, ma'am.
You used the example of someone over in Baker City.
Yes.
Getting their training right there in Baker City as opposed to going to an academy.
Right.
How do you address standards, though? Don't we want all professionals to be trained to the same standard for use of firearms? And how do we ensure that that happens?
We have, Madam Chair, we have a program coordinator in each of the one, I just jotted down about half a dozen, I'm sure there are more. Emergency vehicle operations, firearms, hazardous materials, defensive tactics, patrol tactics, and first aid. Each of those disciplines have people, we have people in the organization that are on top of the emerging trends and issues in their particular subject area, or their subject area of expertise. And they develop a training program for state police officers, and then that program is implemented throughout the state in the most cost-effective and efficient way that we can do it. I don't know that those programs are all, that our programs on firearms qualifications, for example, would line up exactly with the city of Portland's or the city of Eugene's. I don't know, and I think that's a legitimate question. But we're responsible for the liability that attaches to our employees, and we take very, very seriously the need to develop a training program in each one of these subject areas that's going to meet the needs of the officer, meet the needs of the agency, and I do agree that those programs ought to be, those standards ought to be pretty constant across the state, but I don't have control over that, and I really don't believe, Madam Chair, that the Department of Public Safety standards and training, while they certainly can approve those training programs, and they do, they approve the training standards, including ours, that's a different thing than actually doing the training, which I do not think the DPSST Academy is ever going to be able to train every police officer in the state every year on each of these disciplines. It would just have to be a campus many times bigger than it's going to be. There's just thousands and thousands of police officers that have to get trained every year on these subject areas. So, I wanted to point out that there's a lot more in this training arena than might meet the eye. And when we think about what DPSST can do, meaning the training of basic police officers to statewide standards and some management level training, they will do that, and they'll do a fine job of it, and we're going to support them and try to help them be able to deliver those services as well. We're their partner, and those handful of people we do have in training will be situated at the DPSST Academy in office space that's going to be there for them to do their work. Can I answer your question, ma'am?
Somewhat, although I must be frank with you and say that your comments lead me to want to have a conversation in phase two that includes the director of DP of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and yourself, and we have some give and take around this whole standards piece. And, you know, firearms training is just one example.
Sure.
So hold that thought.
I will.
We'll figure out how to.
I appreciate that. I'm not sure if I made it clear or emphasized enough that our training programs are certified by DPSST. So it's in the implementation of them that we can have more.
And I'm hearing the distinction.
Yes,
I am.
I guess just in finally, I'll make the point one more time at the risk of being redundant, and that is that, as Mr. Weiss pointed out, and I heard the chair acknowledge, the point was made with clarity. It's just that after all these, you know, years, the last five biennia in a row, this agency has been cut and cut and cut. And we would love to find out if there's something we're doing that the legislature or the public no longer wants the state police to do. We're listening. Meanwhile, we're trying to hang on by the skin of our teeth to continue to be able to provide services that haven't gone away, even though the budget has been cut and the staff has been cut, and we still have responsibilities to do a job for the people of the state of Oregon that we think the people of this state have every reason to be very proud of their Department of State Police, and we're going to continue to do the very best we can with every dollar you give us. We look forward to phase two.
Comments? Thank you very much. We appreciate your participation, the quality of your participation. We do look forward to phase two, and we thank you for your service. And we thank all of those behind you who have participated with us in helping us understand what it is we need to further discuss the next time we meet. And again, thank you very much
for
being here. Mr. Wilson, do you have any closing comments about the next phase or tomorrow?
On tomorrow, just a reminder, meet here at 1 o'clock, and then OIA will provide transportation to whatever facility you've chosen. I'm told that they plan to be back around 3 o'clock. Maybe not exactly, but sometime
so
around.
So it'll be all touring, no meeting? There'll be no.
There will not be a public hearing like we had up at Coffee Creek. It will be just a tour. And then OIA will start up again with their Phase 1 presentation on Monday.
Anything else for the good or the order? Well, then we are adjourned, and thank you again
thank
very
you.
Much.
Okay.